Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we examine the flourishing of conspiracy theories. Why do they flourish? How dangerous are they? Guest host Sam Smith speaks with two experts.
But first, is the U.S. State Department using its diplomatic efforts to push genetically modified foods into other countries? Our next guest says yes. Dr. Jadira Martinez-Pantoja joins us now. Her PhD thesis traced the United States' multi-pronged efforts to persuade Mexico to allow genetically modified foods. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you here. You've been studying the change in admitting genetically modified foods into Mexico, really by the persuasion of the United States. I wonder if you could start us with what was Mexico's policy before all of this persuasion?
At the advent of GMOs, Mexico was not aware of what was happening with biotechnology and what GMOs were. So it really started to follow some steps that the United States was following. But then Mexico realized that it was kind of dangerous because it's a new technology. So it adopted a strict regulation in which GMOs were not accepted and only were allowed at a very little experimental phase. And the government promulgated a set of regulations to control those experiments. So that's what happened before 2005.
Yeah, they used, I think, the precautionary principle, right?
That's correct.
Explain the precautionary principle for people who don't know.
So precautionary principle, it means that because you don't know what are the effects of this technology, you have to be very precautious about this and take measures so you don't allow new technologies or new events to come into the country. This approach was restrictive and no cultivation or commercialization of GMOs was allowed in Mexico.
And the concern was what?
The concern was that GMOs may contaminate native species in Mexico. The main concern in Mexico is maize because there's a lot of races and varieties in Mexico that they don't exist in some other parts of the world. So environmentalists and government officials were concerned about protecting those biodiversity in Mexico.
And so that started to change when?
That started to change in 2005 when the government promulgated the law on biosafety of genetically modified organisms, in which cultivation, commercialization, and experimentation with GMOs is allowed. Furthermore, this law promotes biotechnology and encourages scientific institutions and agencies in Mexico to promote biotechnology.
So then what you studied was really what you called public diplomacy. And you and I were just talking about, well, is public diplomacy just a different version of public relations? And this is particularly the role of the United States in pushing these GMO, genetically modified foods, into Mexico's public policy to make it more permissive, right? So let's walk through some of the things that happened. Maybe we start with who the various players are, who the actors are. There was the United States departments, so we'll walk through those. Then there are the corporations, and then there are nonprofit organizations. Tell us who these various actors are and what roles they were playing in this kind of battle to change Mexico's policy.
Okay, in this model of public diplomacy that I chose, it was because the GMO issue, it's a domestic and international issue at the same time with different forces acting together. So in the case of international actors that had an effect on this change of policy were the Department of State and also domestic agencies that are intended to work inside the United States but are also having effect and working outside of the country. In this case, the Department of Agriculture and the Foreign Agricultural Service, which have offices at Mexico City, and they are there with the objective of helping business people to make businesses in Mexico or in the United States. So we have these state actors from the government. And then also this persuasion is complemented by multinational corporations. In this case, the biotechnology companies are just six big ones. And including Monsanto and Bayer. And in the case of the non-governmental organizations or non-profit organizations, I identified the main global NGOs that are having campaigns to prevent the adoption of GM foods in the United States and also in Mexico and around the world. So these NGOs are mainly Greenpeace and ETC Group.
ETC Group, what does that stand for?
Erosion Technology and Corporations.
So Greenpeace is opposing the GMO, right?
Yes.
What about this ETC Group?
ETC also opposes to
also
GMOs.
Also opposes. Yes. So they're the two primary oppositional groups.
Yes, correct.
That you were following. In the companies, you mentioned Monsanto. Are there other big corporations involved in all this?
Dow, BASF.
There was one that you mentioned, AgriBio. What is that?
Yes. These biotechnology companies are very smart, and they are making industry groups. So they associate together in industry group, and these industry groups represent them in front of the government and for in front of the public. So they look more friendly to people, and these organizations like Agro, Bio, or Bio, in the case of the United States, are organizations that promote biotechnology and all the advantages that this technology may have. So Bio, that is the main organization, has different representations all over the world.
In
the
case so it's a lobbying group, essentially, right?
Yes, advocacy that's correct. Group, yes.
Right. And PR. So they do PR, they do advocacy, lobbying to governments to promote genetically modified foods.
Yes, that's correct.
And AgriBio, you said it's the umbrella organization that represents all these, Monsanto and all of the others.
Yes. Okay.
And they were very active in Mexico in getting this policy changed.
Yes.
Maybe we should walk through how some of this happened. I was interested in learning about grants and research centers and these ways that you don't really think about when you think about the lobbying and the persuasion that goes on to governments. Can you tell us about some of these methods that these companies and the U.S. government used to persuade?
Sure. In the case of the biotechnology companies, they use different instruments such as opening research centers. So through these research centers, they promote research, and also they are promoting biotechnology. They invite scientists to these centers to participate and obviously leave their knowledge in there. They also use grants and awards. So people that is working in the field of biotechnology and that people that identify the advantages and the good virtues of GMOs is the people that is going to be awarded with these grants.
If you were a scientist and you were studying the harms of genetically modified foods, would you not get any grant money?
Not really.
No, you wouldn't. Okay, and then what about like one of these research institutes? Would you be employed if you wanted to look at the problems of genetically modified foods?
No, not really. And also, if you're a journalist and are documenting and writing some of these disadvantages, you're not going to receive that award.
Walk us through some of that, like what you found.
I found this article from a person that has the same surname as me, Pantoja, and she was writing about the new trends, applications, and promises of biotechnology. And she says that although NGOs mention that this can be a threat to the environment, there are more advantages of using GMOs. So she received an award for best article from a journalist, something like that.
Did you actually find journalists who were looking at the other side that were shunned or from their organizations?
No, but those kind of journalists never really win a grant or something.
Yeah. In terms of the government agencies, all right, so you mentioned the Office of Agriculture. These are the U.S. ones, right? Office of Agriculture, Biotechnology, and Textile and Trade Affairs. Are these all connected to the State Department, the U.S. State Department?
Yeah, this Office of Biotechnology and Textiles is under the Department of State jurisdiction. And this office is intended to promote and change the perception about biotechnology. So I interviewed an official government from this office, and he mentioned that they don't really want to promote specifically any product, But when they are giving speeches or they go on talks overseas, they just mention biotechnology once. However, when I did my research before meeting him, the website of this office explicitly said that the main objective of this office was to change the perception of biotechnology.
To make it seem safer.
Yes, and more helpful for farmers.
Altogether, this is really essentially the U.S. government trying to change the laws of other countries in order to support corporations.
Not really changing the laws, but changing the perception. And changing the perception among policymakers. So if you change the perception among policymakers, they're going to change the laws.
One of the most important aspects, I thought, in your PhD thesis had to do with long-term relationship building. And it seems like this is one of the most important parts of persuasion and lobbying advocacy. How did they do this?
So, for example, the Department of Agriculture to the Foreign Agricultural Service in Mexico City has different programs that help to build relationships in the long term. So, for example, they have a program that it's called Farmers to Farmers. In this program, they bring farmers from Mexico to the United States and they exchange information. And these farmers in the United States can be farmers that are cultivating GMOs or not cultivating GMOs. So they exchange information. And obviously, this program is also sponsored by the Soybean Council, for example, that it's pro-biotechnology. And then it's to change the perception among the farmers that GMOs are really a good choice. So after they go to the United States and they go back to Mexico, they still exchange information and they chat about how your cultivation is going and stuff like that. So Foreign Agriculture Service becomes like a mediator and like the link between these farmers. So in the long term, they are still exchanging communication. They can also ask for a specific course about biotechnology, for example. So that's another instrument that they are utilizing. Different courses, exchange programs, and
so this actually gets the farmers to put pressure on the policymakers.
Yes, because when they go back to Mexico and they change their perception, they feel like, oh, we need this new technology in Mexico. So they talk to directly to policymakers and in order to have a change in the regulations.
What about these nonprofit organizations like you mentioned, Greenpeace and
BTC?
Yes. How have they tried to argue against the inclusion of genetically modified foods in Mexico?
So these groups also have different instruments. For example, Greenpeace also uses lobbying with the government to convince them that GMOs are not a good option. So they also disseminate information, printed publications in which they include the disadvantages of adopting GMOs or the possible harms that it can have to human health or the damage to the environment. So these groups disseminate information, printed publications, and also make protests. So this is a very powerful instrument in which they just go out and gather many people and they protest against GMOs, adopting GMOs. And they have large posters.
But they really lost in this case.
Not really.
No.
No, not really, because with the new law on 2005, GMOs were accepted in a case-by-case basis. But when these NGOs realized that maize was under threat, they set up a lawsuit.
And the one against Monsanto?
Or? Yeah, Monsanto and the Secretariat of Agriculture of Mexico.
They filed that lawsuit what year?
2008.
2008. And what's happened with that lawsuit?
So with that lawsuit, GM maize is not allowed in Mexico still. And in 2014, they also filed a lawsuit to stop the cultivation of GM soy in the peninsula of Yucatan because this cultivation is affecting the production of honey. So they stopped this cultivation of GM soy in Yucatan. So they're really having an effect because they have gathered many people, they lobby, they disseminate information.
And it's information that's counter to what the research centers are finding, it sounds like. So you've got these smallish compared to big government and big business finding information that is counter to all of these government-funded, corporate-funded research centers that are all saying it's safe.
Yes, because these organizations don't have the same amount of money that the big corporations have, but they do independent research and also use independent scientists to document their findings.
Mexico, it sounded like, from what I gathered from your work, is increasingly adopting these genetically modified foods, with few exceptions. Is that also a problem of access? Access to policymakers, access to really have face-to-face discussion?
Yes, you're correct. That is because of access and resources. So they have some victories, as they call them, at a local level, but they don't have access to big policymakers, or they don't have access to the president. And in Mexico, the president is very important because this is a very hierarchical government. So the president almost mandates everything. In the case of the multinational corporations, they have access to the president. So that's why it's easier to have an influence over these regulations. In the case of NGOs, they don't have this, and they don't have more resources to make more protests or more publications or more lobbying in general.
Let's talk about the structure in the Mexican government. You mentioned that they don't really have strong enough regulatory bodies to deal with this in your thesis. You also mentioned that they were patterning some of their bureaucracy after the United States bureaucracy so that there would be a harmony. Talk us through the government and why it matters.
For Mexico, it's very important to be harmonized with the United States because of the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. So for Mexican policymakers, it's very important to be aligned to the regulations of the United States. So in the case of Mexico, he was adopting like the same structure of the United States. In the case of the United States, when GMOs were born, the United States created the biotechnology framework in which the Department of Agriculture, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Food and Drug Administration are the ones that decide what GMOs are going to be released into the environment and are going to be used for food. So Mexico followed the same example, and it has the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Environment, and the regulatory body for food that authorizes the GMOs that are going to be released or going to be authorized for human consumption. So they follow the same pattern, although at the beginning for Mexico, the regulation was more strict and it really didn't allow GMOs. And now, especially the Department of Agriculture from the United States and from Mexico, they share a lot of information about biotechnology, new trends, new regulation, because it's very important to be harmonized and have the same sort of approvals because it's easier to make business.
What period of time were you looking at this?
It was a little bit from 1991. Then in 2005, it was the biggest change because of this new law. And then also in 2009, there was a new change on the law because Mexico was supposed to be the center of origin for diversity for corn. But in 2009, from the 32 states that there are in Mexico, only 8 states were recognized as centers of origin for corn. So that's another important point of time in Mexico, in which I focus in my research. And why did this happen? Because the president of Mexico had chat or some communication with the CEO of Monsanto. So that's why this is an important point of time for my research.
Some of this happened then during the Bush administration, and some of it happened during the Obama administration. And so under the State Department, especially the latter one, this was occurring under Hillary Clinton as well. Did you get a sense that it was the same policies out of both administrations? 2005 being George Bush, State Department, 2008 being Obama State Department. Same types of policies?
Yes, mainly they are basically the same because one can expect that obviously Republicans promote businesses, but in the case of Obama, it followed the same trend on promoting businesses abroad. So, yes.
Do you think you'll look at this policy in other countries as well?
Yes, and we have the example of Brazil. So in Brazil, GMOs were being smuggled, but now they are...
Smuggled by...
Some other countries in South America. So the farmers bought in the black market the seeds and then planted in Brazil because they didn't have regulations for that. But now they're changing the regulations and they're accepting and planting GMOs openly, and they are in negotiations with Monsanto for bringing this technology.
Are there positives for the farmers for some of these GMOs? Does it yield more crop, for example?
It depends, because if we take a look at the United States, and GMOs were designed for the fields of the United States. So it really helps. They can have higher yields. But in the case of Mexico, these GMOs are not very suitable because the design was different. So I'm not sure if it can fit for the Brazilian fields, but it doesn't matter because the important objective here is to sell more products overseas.
Yeah.
So yes, it can be also applied for Asia or the rest of Latin America.
And so that's going to be your next focus of research.
Yes, Latin America.
Yeah.
Especially.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Jadira Martinez Pantoja. It's great to have you here.
Thank you very much, Maria, for inviting me.
When we come back,
we examine the flourishing of conspiracy theories.
Stay tuned.
Basin Street is a street where all them characters from the first precinct meet. In New Orleans, city of a million dreams, and you never know how nice it seems when you're way down south in New Orleans and you be hugging and a-kissing. That's what I've been missing. Hear all that good music, Lord, if you just listen. Yeah, New Orleans is true. And that's why I got these Basin Street blues.
Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Today's panel lays the foundations of the flourishing of conspiracy theories. Why do they flourish? How dangerous are they? Guest host Sam Smith speaks with two experts.
My name is Sam Smith, and today we're going to be talking about conspiracy theories. What are they? Are they dangerous? How do they develop? I'm joined in the studio by M. Dentith. He has a PhD from the University of Auckland and is an expert in the epistemology of conspiracy theories. He's also the author of The Philosophy of Conspiracy Theories. I'm also joined by Patrick Stokes. He's a senior lecturer in philosophy at Deakin University, and he's an expert in the ethics of conspiracy theories and has also written quite widely about this topic. So I'd like to start with you, Em. Could you give us a basic definition of what a conspiracy theory is?
So this is a definition which doesn't necessarily conform to ordinary usage, although I'll put a sidebar there. There's a question here as to whether there is an ordinary usage of this thing called conspiracy theory. But I define a conspiracy theory as any explanation of an event that cites a conspiracy as a salient cause.
What would you add to that, Pat?
I think that is probably the dominant definition in the epistemology literature on conspiracy theories. Others, and M knows this better than me, but others have tried to add extra bits and pieces. Like some people say it has to be for a morally disreputable purpose, or it has to be counter to an official narrative. So there have been attempts, but it's been paired right back to that very, very formal definition, which raises the worry for some of us, well, for me, that we maybe aren't quite getting with that definition at exactly what people talk about in the street when they say conspiracy theory. So there's an interesting tension there between a revisionary definition, if you like, that's really usable in philosophy versus a really messy, probably non-definition that the average person uses.
Do all conspiracies fall under one definition, or are there quite a few different types of definitions?
I think there's a number of different types. They probably all do fall under that definition just because it is so kind of capacious. There are different kinds. I've made the distinction between, for instance, conspiracy theories that are born conspiratorial. So they start by looking at an event and saying, this is the result of a conspiracy. On the other hand, there are some theories that become conspiratorial as a result of trying to defend a theory, for instance. So they may not be a conspiracy theory, but then when other evidence comes in, they'll say, oh, well, the reason that, you know, the theory looks bad is because somebody's working to cover this up.
Would you agree with that, Em?
Yes. I mean, I think the problem when we're talking about these things called conspiracy theories is that there are a lot of things which are called conspiracy theories, some of which aren't even theories about conspiracies. So Jesse Walker, who's a contributor to the Joe Usinski book, Conspiracy Theories and the People Who Believe Them, points out that after MH17 disappeared, one media organization listed 10 weird conspiracy theories about the disappearance of that Malaysian airline, including it was swallowed by a black hole. And as he pointed out, black holes are not conspiratorial. It's just a weird belief. But often when we talk about conspiracy theories, there's a conflation between theories which are about conspiratorial activity and stories that we just take to be false or unlikely. So it's very hard to kind of narrow down what the ordinary usage of conspiracy theory is, which is kind of why I go for this kind of capacious definition of conspiracy theory, because I think it's the most useful one for the analysis of theories about conspiracies, even if it doesn't necessarily map on to how the ordinary language user talks about things called conspiracy theories.
So how do conspiracy theories begin exactly, and how is it that some manage to survive over time while others kind of disappear?
Well, so there are kind of two dominant discourses that will explain this. So you'll get what we call the generalist position, which will put down conspiracy theories to some kind of epistemic or psychological pathology. So they're malformed beliefs by people interacting with the world and coming to the wrong conclusions, at which point conspiracy theories are almost always likely to be false by this particular kind of view. And because of that, they're formed in malformed ways, and it can be all sorts of reasons, whether it be you're psychologically conditioned to see conspiracies where they aren't, you have an epistemic fault where you infer the existence of a conspiracy without considering competing explanations and the like. And then you get what's called the particularist position, which is kind of dominant in those of us who do the philosophy of conspiracy theory, that go, well, look, conspiracy theories often form with relation to evidence, and sometimes they're malformed and sometimes they're well-formed. And so you need to look at what evidence people put forward and what kind of assumptions they're operating with. So, I mean, I spent a year and a half working in Romania. Romania is a very corrupt political space. They have an openly corrupt government. Romanians suspect conspiracies are behind an awful lot of things that go on in the Romanian political sphere. So they suspect conspiracies because conspiracy is normal in that space. Well, Pat and I come from a much more benign political space, or though maybe Aotearoa New Zealand's a lot more benign than Australia is at this particular point in time. And so we kind of think of conspiracies as being relatively rare in our political situation, and thus we're less likely to assume that that's a kind of a primary cause for events in our political space.
What would you add to that, Pat?
One thing that's worth noting about the etiology of conspiracy theory, Em's quite right, in some ways it is going to come down to how conspired you take your body politic to be. And that's going to a certain extent, license how reasonable any of these beliefs are going to be. But it's also noticeable that a lot of them seem to follow predefined sort of narratives or predefined sort of structures for what you think explains a certain kind of action. So if you look, for instance, at a thing that happens anytime there's a sort of a mass casualty event in the US, there'll almost instantly be some move to declare that it's some sort of false flag exercise, that either it didn't really happen, which doesn't make it a false flag, it makes it something else, or it did happen, but it was the government who perpetrated it. That's a very, very common, if you like, trope. And the same kind of explanatory trope or explanatory picture keeps being redeployed in different contexts. So in some ways, when we look at the origins of these theories, we also have to look at the way in which there's a social practice, if you like, that's being appealed to. And that social practice will differ according to different contexts. So it may look very different in an avowedly corrupt society where conspiracies turn out to be happening all the time compared to a more transparent sort of society. I have in the past, and I know this is kind of perhaps buying into it, the pathologizing view, which people don't necessarily like, but I have in the past sometimes said in some ways conspiracy theories, when they become kind of excessive or you know, frequently happening, are something kind of analogous to hypochondria rather than an illness itself, where you're just kind of seeing every signal that comes out of the body politic as sinister. Everything is meaningful and everything is sinister. So there's no noise, it's all signal, and everything has some dark meaning behind it. So in some ways, quite analogous to what happens to the hypochondriac, where their body has become opaque to themselves. Every single thing that happens is clearly meaningful and it clearly portends disaster. So there's interesting things to be said about the etiology of conspiracy theories, which in some ways sit awkwardly with what, as philosophers, we might want to do, which is just try and come up with a nice, clear definition and see how rational that definition is.
I'd like to turn to the role of the internet and the media in sort of contributing to the rise of conspiracy theories and culture. How has the internet contributed, firstly, to the rise of conspiracy theory culture? Very recently, we've heard a lot about 8chan and 4chan, for example.
So the internet plays, I think, a fairly important role with why we talk about conspiracy theories. So what I'm going to about say now is contentious amongst conspiracy theory scholars. There was a book that came out in 2014 called American Conspiracy Theories, written by Joe Usinski and Joe Parent. And they looked at a whole bunch of letters to the editor in newspapers in the US over the 20th century, trying to map as to when the peak of conspiracy theorizing was going on in US discourse. And they kind of say, well, look, the 1960s is the peak of when people were talking about conspiracy theories. And actually, conspiracy theories have been in steady decline ever since. And of course, this ends up being contentious amongst scholars of conspiracy theory because anecdotally, conspiracy theories look really, really popular at the moment. And Usinski and Parent go, well, that might just be a reporting thing. Because conspiracy theories are even more rare than usual, they actually end up being more notable. And so the media reports on them more, and thus we hear about them more. In the same respect, there's been a general decline in criminal activity in Western nations over the latter part of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st century, which has conversely led to increased reporting of crime because crime is more notable. So there is a question here as to whether conspiracy theories are the big issue they appear to be. But they certainly are very easily spread because in the old days, and the old days is back in the 1960s or so, if you had a conspiracy theory and you wanted people to learn about it, you'd have to write a letter to the editor in a magazine, publish an article in a magazine, or write a book. And then you'd have to wait for people to read that material. Then you'd have to wait for people to reply to that material. And then you might engage in a really, really prolonged discussion of that material for years and years and years. Now, if I were to, say, put a conspiracy theory up on my blog, I would have people responding to it within hours, if not minutes, of the post going up. And so there's been a kind of weird focusing effect we're seeing with the internet. It's very easy to find out about conspiracy theories now.
Pat?
I'd add to that too that not only is it easy to find out about conspiracy theory, but with any kind of countercultural or counter-consensus belief of any sort, it's much, much easier to find your people now, right? It's much, much easier to find a community of people who believe the same things you do or are at least inclined to go down the same kind of pathways, which means that it's much easier to sustain these sorts of views because there's people around you who are prepared to constitute what M would call a community of inquiry, taking a term from the pragmatists, who do actually explore and investigate these ideas, but also give you some validation, if you like, and make it much easier to maintain that sort of belief. So there's a point about speed of dissemination of conspiracy theory, but there's also a point about the way in which epistemic communities can arise that can reinforce these beliefs amongst each other. So, I mean, it's not a conspiracy theory, although it maybe generates conspiracy theory, but something like flat earth belief, which is kind of the shorthand now for, you know, irrational belief or whatever, that not only is much easier to disseminate now, but it's also much, much easier to build a community of people and say, well, okay, maybe this is a rational thing to believe because so many of the people around me seem to entertain it as a serious view. It's much easier to form those communities now.
How dangerous can it be for a conspiracy theory to flourish and the culture around certain conspiracy theories?
Depends by what you mean by dangerous. There's two ways of looking at this. One is a consequentialist way, which is to say that conspiracy beliefs do often motivate people to do harmful sorts of things. We saw that with the Pizzagate controversy in the US not long ago, for instance, people actually, you know, bursting into restaurants with guns and things. The reply to that you can make, of course, is that in that conspiracy theories are neither a necessary nor sufficient condition for someone doing these sorts of things. Plenty of beliefs that are non-conspiratorial motivate people to do terrible things, and plenty of conspiracy theorists don't do terrible things. So there's that. I think in some ways conspiracy theory does make it easier to make accusations against people, for instance. So it's psychologically probably a bit easier to harass, say, a grieving parent by saying your child never really existed and you're a crisis actor. It's probably much easier to do that if you have a prior commitment to the world being a certain way and to a conspiracy as the best explanation for a certain kind of event. There's also, and this is somewhere where I know Em and I disagree, there's also a broader issue about whether conspiracy theory licenses accusation and whether simply accusing someone contains a certain kind of non-consequential moral wrong in itself. That is, if we have a duty to think well of people, does entertaining conspiracy theories make us more likely to conclude that people are not what they appear to be, or they're actually doing terrible things that they don't acknowledge doing?
What would you say to that, Em?
Yes, so Pat and I have had quite a discussion about this in the past, and actually part of that discussion goes on in a book we're both in, Taking Conspiracy Theories Seriously, edited by myself, published by Roman and Littlefield last year. Now, I think part of that can be mopped up by trying to assess what kind of society you're in. So once again, in the Australian Aotearoa New Zealand context, where conspiracies are, as far as we're concerned, relatively rare, maybe we do kind of have a duty to be trusting to one another all the time, or at least most of the time. Whilst if you're in a corrupt polity where your levels of trust are very, very low, or imagine growing up under the Stasi in Germany, a situation where you really can't trust that your neighbours are looking after you, then you will have a completely different attitude towards these things. And the ethics of passing how you talk about conspiracy will change depending on the culture or historical time you're in. I also think it's important to note that, yes, it is true, some conspiracy theorists do terrible things, and as Pat points out, that's because some people just do terrible things anyway, sometimes because of conspiracy theories, sometimes for other rationales. But also, conspiracy theorizing as a phenomena can also be a useful release valve in a democratic system, because we need to be aware that there could be conspiracies going on in our political system now. We know conspiracies have occurred. We need to be attentive to the idea that they could occur again. And normally we're pretty concerned if there's a political conspiracy, because that tends to mean that politicians are up to something that they don't want the public to know about. And the presumption there is because it's, if not suspicious activity, sorry, if not sinister activity, it could be actually suspicious activity that needs to be checked nonetheless. So, I mean, there are negative consequences to belief in conspiracy theories, but there are also positive social consequences as well.
Anything there you want to pick up on, Pat?
A flip side to that too that's sometimes been noted is that while there's probably, you may say that part of what we need in any sort of healthy polity is a kind of standing distrust of power, a standing suspicion of power. And I think that's true. But it's also worth noting that looking for conspiracies can make us try and interpret events in terms of deliberate agency on the part of powerful actors, right, can make us look at these things and say, these people are deliberately and consciously trying to bring this about. And that can also then be in tension with the fact that very often we need to look at our societies in terms of how things happen that no one intends, but that are actually the result of institutional structures or forms of power where, you know, Foucault makes this point quite often, that power doesn't necessarily need projects. Power can sometimes just act on people and on things without anyone intending for things to come out a certain kind of way. So there is a kind of a tension there. You don't want to become, there's a distinction in literature, I can't think, remember who makes this, and we'll remember, but there's a distinction between institutional theorists and conspiracy theorists. So an institutional theorist will interpret everything as a result of impersonal institutional power forces. A conspiracy theorist might interpret everything in terms of individual agency. And the truth is almost certainly going to be a mix of those two things. You don't want to be blind to either of them.
I'd now like to talk about some specific examples of conspiracy theories, starting with recently we've had obviously the Christchurch terrorist attack, and the internet kind of went wild with a lot of conspiracies. Pat mentioned false flags earlier. What have you seen, Em, around this issue?
So the afternoon of March 15th, I actually had a friend who was actually down in Christchurch, so I was sitting at my computer writing on conspiracy theories, got a text from my friend saying, I'm just near the mosque where the shootings occurred, which was the first time I heard about the shootings. Went online, almost immediately, because I'm used to looking for these things, found a 4chan thread about it, found a link to the manifesto, read the manifesto. I can talk about that publicly. I applied for an exemption to be able to hold a copy of the manifesto for research purposes. And suddenly we had this fully formed, within minutes of the event occurring, false flag hypothesis. People saying, well, I've watched the video and it looks as if it's staged, or it looks like it's, you know, it's using crisis actors of some particular kind. And yeah, this conspiracy theory emerged almost immediately. And I think that is part of what Pat's talking about here, about there being particular narratives. When you get a mass shooting, there is a certain class of person who thinks this event is so extraordinary that it must be fake in some sense, and immediately latch on to a kind of false flag mass shooting hypothesis, which then goes, well, if it's been faked, who could have faked it? Why was it faked? What's the rationale behind it? Which, of course, is then in tension with the actual manifesto of the shooter, which goes to very great lengths to talk about how long he took to plan the event and exactly what his motivation for the event was.
Pat, your response?
That event is an interesting one in the sense that this may be part of why false flags type conspiracies do occur so much now, or rather the accusation of them occurs. Maybe precisely because that was such a mediated event. I mean, obviously not for the people who were there for the tragedy, but it was an event that was increasingly, like other mass casualty events, is presented to us almost in a kind of, you know, heavily mediated sort of way where we can see things, but it's not, it's, so it's there, but it's not there. And that perhaps does lead people into this kind of distrust of spectacular society, which can lead people down that route. But also, again, as I say, if you're antecedently committed to the idea that false flag events happen and happen fairly routinely, that this is a thing that Western governments do, then it's going to be much easier to immediately interpret new surprising events and shocking events through that explanatory lens. Like you've already got, which we do with everything, right? When an event happens, we immediately have our kind of explanatory repertoires that we draw on to explain how this unexpected thing has come about. If a big part of your explanatory repertoire is the government acts behind the scenes and fakes this stuff, then it seems like that's going to be something that's going to be much easier to apply more or less automatically.
Some events through history have had led to some massive conspiracy theory industries around them, so to speak. I'm thinking here 9/11, truthers, the moon landing, John F. Kennedy's assassination. Why is it that events like these have taken on such a big mass industry scale, I guess, around them?
Some of it is due to the way in which governments responded. So one of the interesting things about the assassination of JFK and the aftermath was the formation of the Warren Commission, which produced the Warren Commission report, which was made of party political insiders that people were suspicious would be there to kind of cover things up rather than reveal details. They then produce a report, the Warren Commission report, which is a set of volumes with no index whatsoever, and all of the evidence kind of put in a fairly random hodgepodge manner, which then led people to go, well, what are they trying to hide by trying to confound us? Now, the reality is that no one actually thought the Warren Commission report would ever be read, so there was no need to have an index. There was no need to be systematic with the approach of putting all the evidence down. But it turned out that JFK was a beloved president. People wanted to know why exactly did this lone gunman do what he did. And so the report and the response to the assassination, even if it wasn't a conspiracy, looked like a cover-up of some kind. So I can kind of understand why people conspiracy theorize around JFK. And I can kind of also understand why it continues to be a big issue, because people don't feel it's been dealt with properly, although I would argue actually there's been several very good books that really do put the final nail in the coffin to show that Oswald really was the person who did the event. Things like the moon landing are slightly more interesting. I think in part because the growth of moon landing fakery stories don't really occur at the time the moon landing occurs. They really start to occur when we're not going to the moon anymore. And so there's this question of, well, we went to the moon, apparently. We're not going to the moon now. Was it all just an elaborate fake-out? So it's kind of post hoc reasoning, trying to explain why we appeared to have this really spectacular space program at one particular point in time, and yet now we've just left the moon alone.
What would you add to that, Pat?
The thing with JFK and also, say, Diana, right? So there's a whole bunch of conspiracy theories around the death of Princess Diana. Part of what's going on there too, I think, is that we just psychologically have a bias against the idea that big events can have mundane causes. And the thought that the president could be driving down the street and just get shot by a random guy from a window, or that, you know, the Princess of Wales can die just because of a drunk driver. Those sorts of thoughts somehow offend our sense of the proper scale on which causation should work. And so we do try to reach for more larger or more elaborate events. Government responses, as Em says, are also really important. I mean, in the case of JFK, some of the data that's come out fairly recently suggests there was actually a bit of a conspiracy going on there, but it wasn't to kill the president. It was basically the CIA and the FBI not wanting to come out that they did actually know quite a bit about Oswald, and they really should have been able to stop this. So that stuff's interesting. Also, yeah, with the moon landing as well, there's the interesting fact that not only is it something that we stopped doing, it's also the fact that it's something that the average person has no epistemic access to. I think the way conspiracy belief operates in some ways is going to be sociologically very interestingly connected to the increasing lack of connection that we have to, or that the average person has, to the knowledge-generating mechanisms of society. We went to the moon. How do we know? Well, here's a bunch of photos we took. You're just going to have to trust us. Human activity is causing massive climate change that threatens to destroy us all. How do we know? Well, we have to offload that to scientists because most of us can't simply work that out for ourselves. Increasingly, we have this thing about distributed knowledge, right? That the expertise and knowledge is distributed among experts, which means that for most people, you have to take this stuff on trust. And you've got maybe if you're more and more alienated from those knowledge-generating mechanisms, then you've got less and less reason to trust them, and more reason to see them as potentially being sinister or motivated against you. I think that's linked to it too.
Of course, not all conspiracies are overtly political. Some are kind of, I guess, more weird, or I guess they're quite fun to laugh at. I'm thinking people who are flat earthers or believe in the Illuminati or the 2012 Maya apocalypse idea. What do you make of some of those conspiracies?
Yeah, some of them are just kind of, they have the appearance of games. And sometimes they take off beyond that, right? So the Paul McCartney is dead one, right, which started in the late 60s. Again, started basically as a joke. And what you can do is you can take one of these premises and then it then becomes a fun sort of game to try and put as much evidence together as you can for that. The Germans have got a really good one. There's one particular town in Germany and it's like clearly this town doesn't exist because you don't know anyone has ever been there. And so there's all these kind of things like that. Well, the Australia doesn't exist one, which is a good one, actually, that Australia is a fake, which apparently circulated among some flat earthers. The thing is, of course, that those ideas can then connect with people who maybe have mental health issues or other problems as well. And they can actually go into some pretty dark places. So if you look into, for instance, the Paul McCartney is dead stuff, you pretty quickly stumble upon some websites that are disturbing or elusive, because of course these ideas can really resonate with people who might be in a bit of a dark place and can generate some stuff that's well outside the intended kind of fun spirit of the original theory.
Him?
Another thing to note about these things is that there's a difference between being a true believer in some conspiracy theory and being someone who is willing to entertain the conspiracy theory but not being committed to its truth. I mean, so it's fairly clear that for a period of time in the 20th century and the early 21st century, the Flat Earth Society was something you joined as a bit of a joke. It was one of those things, oh, I'm a flat earther. Do you believe the Earth is flat? Well, it could be, but people didn't really believe it. They were just entertaining the idea. And I think, as Pat points out, the Paul McCartney is dead thing started off as a bit of a joke, where it was a fun conspiracy theory to talk about because it allowed you to go, well, look, we actually know so little about Paul McCartney's personal life, and there are all these gaps in the story that suddenly you can fill those gaps by putting a hypothesis. But what if he died? And it turns out people have done the same thing with Britney Spears. They've done the same thing with Avril Lavigne. There are all of these conspiracy theories that X was replaced with Y at point blah for some rationale. And it's not clear that people are serious about these. They're simply entertaining them. And that's something we need to kind of remember when we talk about conspiracy theories, is that not every conspiracy theorist is committed to the truth of the conspiracy theory they espouse. Sometimes they're simply entertaining an idea because it might be true, but if you push them, they're not actually going to say, I absolutely believe it. On another point, the town in question is Beelford, and it turns out that when I was in Romania last, I met someone who allegedly went to the university there, although frankly I found her stories very, very implausible.
Now, both of you study conspiracies theories, obviously, but do either of you actually believe any conspiracy theories? So start with Pat.
I don't know. To be honest, the ones I'd be most likely to believe would be, I'd be most likely to believe the idea that it was someone other than Oswald, or that Oswald didn't act alone. That to me has a certain plausibility to it, but I don't necessarily think it's true. I can't think of any off the top of my head that I do believe, but I'm sure I suppose you could say there are ones that I believe that everyone accepts, all right? So the Gulf of Tonkin incident was bigged up to justify the invasion of Vietnam, for instance. Those sorts of things I think most of us kind of just accept. This is a point that some of our colleagues have made, which is that in a sense everyone's a conspiracy theorist because everyone believes that at least certain conspiracy events did actually happen.
Yeah.
I mean, my standard response here is I'm more interested in talking about the theory of conspiracy theory. I don't want people to think that I'm prejudging my conclusions by saying I believe X or Y. But yes, the shortcut to that is historical events, which were the result of conspiracy, Gulf of Tonkin, the assassination of Julius Caesar, the Moscow show trials, the Watergate affair. Depending on how you want to define things, the dodgy dossier motivation for the invasion of Iraq in 2003 all seem to be clear cases of cover-ups and collusion that led to events that were pejoratively labelled as conspiracy theories by people in power at the time, but turned out to be warranted on the evidence nonetheless. So in that particular respect, yes, there are a whole bunch of historical conspiracy theories that I'm quite willing to say, yes, those things really were beliefs that were resulting from conspiracies.
Final thoughts. Pat, what do you see as the future being like for conspiracy theory culture? Do you think it's going to continue to grow, or is it going to continue a decline, so to speak?
I think it probably will, just in the sense that there's been a definite kind of shift, or seems to have been a definite kind of shift, in terms of people's willingness to take on board certain kinds of epistemic authority which had previously been arrogated to other kind of knowledge-generating mechanisms. So what I mean by that is people are just much less inclined to believe what governments or universities or doctors tell them is the case. And in that context of this much greater kind of epistemic suspicion, I think it's quite likely that we'll continue to see conspiracy theories offered, because very often to sustain those sorts of beliefs, you have to posit the corruption of a lot of these very powerful actors. So I don't see them going away anytime soon. I think they're probably perennial, but I also think that the times suit conspiracy theories, to put it that way.
Final thoughts from you, Im.
Yeah, so I think part of the issue, of course, is that we currently have a leader of a world superpower who engages in conspiracy rhetoric all the time. So even if there was a kind of breakdown in general trust in the population over time, which may or may not be justified depending on the kind of information you have about the world in which you live, when you have someone in charge of the US, like Donald Trump, who engages in conspiracy talk a lot and uses that to energize and enrage the base, then conspiracy theories become a really big issue. And given that there is this angst in America at the moment, can we fix our political system and go back to how things used to be, which still had a fair amount of conspiracy talk in it, but it was polite conspiracy talk, so it was acceptable. We may well be stuck for the foreseeable future in a world where conspiracy theories are going to become a political tool that people use rather overtly. I mean, we're seeing that with Brexit in the UK. We're seeing the rise of that with populist governments in the EU. Arguably, it was a major part of the Australian election from just a week ago. It doesn't seem to be a major issue in Aotearoa New Zealand at the moment, but our election is still a year and a bit away, and we really don't know whether we're going to follow the leader or continue to be a little benign dot on the landscape.
Right. Well, thank you very much, both of you, Patrick Stokes and Im Denter. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Absolute pleasure.
Im Denter is an expert in the epistemology of conspiracy theories. He's also the author of The Philosophy of Conspiracy Theories. Patrick Stokes is a senior lecturer in philosophy at Deakin University, and he's an expert in the ethics of conspiracy theories and has also written quite widely about this topic.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
We took a heaven on earth, they call it bliss. Now ain't you glad you went with me? Straight on down that Mississippi.